I call this meeting the House Finance Committee to order, and let the record reflect that the time is currently 5:05 p.m. on Tuesday, April 10th, 2018. Present today, we have Representative Ortiz, Representative Kawasaki, Representative Wilson, Co-Chair Seaton, Representative Tilton, Representative Gren, Representative Guttenberg, Representative Thompson, and myself, Co-Chair Foster. Before we start, if folks could mute their cell phones. On today's schedule, we are going to be taking up the introduction of HB 411, which is the oil and gas production tax payments credits. Tonight's plan is for an introduction of the bill, followed by a PowerPoint presentation from the Department of Revenue. So at this time, I would like to bring up Representative Seaton and Elizabeth Diamant, aide to Representative Seaton. And if you could both put yourselves on the record and begin with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Paul Seaton, District 31, from representing the lower Kenai Peninsula.
And for the record, Elizabeth Diamond, staff to Representative Seaton.
Mr. Chairman, to give a little background on this bill, the background is House Bill 411, which we passed last year over to the Senate. It was dealing with oil and gas taxes and oil and gas credits, and the conference committee that dealt at the end of last session did not address any of the changes to the production tax. They used the bill to work on the credits, and we revised those so that the credits are no longer issued on the North Slope. So what we're doing here is looking at the update of the segment of House Bill 111, which has been in Senate resources for a year, and it's the tax portions that we're looking at. House Bill 111 also established a legislative working group, and this was done in the conference committee, and it was to analyze the state's fiscal regime for oil and gas, to review changes for the legislature, and to bring those forward in the second session of the legislature. The group has only met twice, once on October 24th, 2017, and the other time was on January 18th of 2018. No recommendations were made to the legislature, and although the legislature has three sets of consultants for oil and gas taxes, only one was requested to make a single presentation to the group. So this is taking the bill almost identical to what was passed over by the House last year to the Senate. So, Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to say that, you know, there's a basic rule of thumb that worldwide about two-thirds of the wealth of an oil regime goes to the non-producers, or it's called government take. In our situations, that has often been looked at as a third, a third, and a third. A third federal government, a third state, and a third to the producers. However, what we have right now is a case in which the producers today are, it's estimated their share is 48% instead of a third, and that's 48% compared to 37% just last year. So the state is not getting its fair share of revenue from either the legacy fields, the old oil, or the other section of oil, which is called new oil. So House Bill 411 is designed to bring that back, that government take or non-producer share back into about that range. So this bill is simple, Mr. Chair. It does three things. It eliminates the per barrel credit. and for legacy production that was a sliding scale, so it got larger as the price went down, and so it became a bigger and bigger piece of the production. And of course, if you get rid of the per barrel credits, the 35% profits tax is too high a rate across all of those. So this returns it to the 25% that was the original proposal from Governor Parnell in SB 21. And it also does one difference from last year. In House Bill 111, the tax rate was 25%, and then there was a single bracket that jumped 15% for a max of 40. And so this bill smooths that out with 3-5% tax progressive, but still based on the bracket. So, Mr. Chairman, we'll go through the presentation here, and just to go back to that third kind of concept, you can see here that Daniel Johnson, in who was one of our consultants in 26, said the world average government take right now, and that was back then, is probably 67 or 70%, depending upon how you calculate it. And one of the other consultants, Wood McKenzie, aggregates it a little differently, but theirs was about 71%. And if you look at the, in 2007, and these were for various years, you can see that all of these, whether it's Senate Finance, Senate Judiciary, the House bill, PPT expected, SB 2001, all of those ranged. If you're looking at the prices down at the far left of $40 a barrel up through $80 a barrel, they're all ranging in the 60 to 70%. So that's kind of that two-thirds. So if we take another look here, you'll see that the Senate TAPS Throughput Committee, this was a presentation that was made to them by the then consultant Janik Meyer and Tony Ranch, and here is their $60 per barrel worldwide regimes at that time, and you can see the red intermediate ones in the middle were still in that 60 to 66% range. And so you can see that over time we've been looking at all those things. I'm going to go right to this slide here, which is the ConocoPhillips slide that was presented on House Bill 111, Senate Finance. And this is, you can see at $65 a barrel, there was 37% of the net profits, I should say production tax value, because it's pre-tax, and the term net profits likes to be used for after taxes are paid. But the producer share was 37%, and slightly higher than the one-third, and the state's share was 43, and you can see the note that they had on the top up there. The state always has the largest share and is positive even when the industry is negative. And so, but you can see it's always staying about 35 at very high prices. It was 35, and then it grew a little bit down into the $75 range, the 38% producer share, and then it dropped off 37 and back to 35%. At about $60 a barrel. And now if we look at their same slide from 2018, you'll see that the note at the top no longer says the state share is higher than the producer share. And if you look at $65 a barrel, you'll see that the producer share is now 48%, and the state share has dropped to 39%. So within these ranges, you can see they're all about the same. It drops a little at $60. They're still 47%, and the state's is 40%. You know, part of this diminution of share was the federal tax rate change, but 4% was taken somehow right out of the state share as well. So if we take a look at this illustration, these are the taxable costs and tax market price at $63 a barrel. You can see it's $10.7 billion, but you can see on that far right column as it goes down, the gross value is still 9.2 after you take transportation costs off. But then lease expenditures are fairly high, takes about half of it. So the production tax value, that's after all of those expenses, is $4.7 billion. The tax at 35% would have been $16.50. But the per barrel credit eats up $1.35 billion of that. So there's only $300 million left. And the gross minimum tax, which is what we've been operating basically on since 2015, is only 4%. So remember, these tax rate is, we receive the 4% minimum tax because the actual way that the budget is with these, the calculation is with these per barrel credits is even less than the 4% minimum tax. And we're not even talking about the tax credits that are with the amount that's taken out to pay for cashable tax credits. That's a calculation on the state's end that has nothing to do with the value split between the producer and the state. And so looking at what that means is, you know, from the very start of oil production through 1986, the effective production tax rate was above 14%. And, you know, that was a gross tax as well. And you can see these other tax rates as how they've gone down over time, 95, 11.8%. Going down to 10.5, 2001, you can see it's dropping. And that 6.7% is when we totally revised the tax rate because there was not enough value being left with the state. And so that's when we went to a profits-based tax. And but unfortunately, the way the whole tax worked with a change that was made in House Resources, not the original version at all, was to put this sliding scale, a very regressive for the state portion, that is, for every $10 below about $105, that the price dropped, an extra dollar was pushed across the table per barrel to the producers, so it got up to $8 per barrel at lower prices. And so what does this bill do? Again, it does three things. First of all, it repeals the per barrel credits, and then it lowers the production tax rate from 35% to 25%. And it establishes an additional 5% tax bracket at production tax values. And remember, that's after the expenses are all subtracted. At $40 of production tax value, it adds a 5% bracket. At $50 of, you could call it gross profit, it adds another 5%. And at $60, it adds a third. And like I say, last year in this bill that we passed over, it had the same 15% increase. And that was simply one larger increase at $60. So this smooths things out. And this was a run from the Department of Revenue looking at this tax form. You can see the red, and you can see it goes up above 50% there, which is at the very high prices. And the blue is where we have in those steps and diminution in the state's value come as the price goes lower. And you can see that down at the bottom end, we are not getting much tax for this 35% tax. That green line is a 25% profit tax, and you can see how much lower it is than that. And you can see the calculations down below. ANS West Coast in that box just below the graphs, you'll see that there's no change at 40, and at $50 there would have been $292. And this is a we'll have the Department of Revenue explain why it looks different in this scenario than it does in the fiscal note. But at around $60 a barrel, it's $605 million. We're getting a true 25% profits tax at that point, so that's all we're taxing. But it depends on the field. If you have a very expensive field, all of those expenses get subtracted, so there's much less profit, so there's much less pushed across, as we'll see in just a moment. This is called non-gross value reduction oil, or non-GVR oil, meaning our legacy fields. All of the, you can see the progressive steps down there. When you see that first trigger of $40, remember again, that's not the ANS West Coast. That's on the bottom of the graph itself. Those are ANS Alaska North Slope West Coast prices. And so when you have your first trigger, that's adding about $30 a barrel to that. So that first trigger point is barely perceptible, comes in a little above $70, and then at $50 per production tax, that's $80. And the third one is basically at $90. And so that's where we are. And it still maintains, doesn't change the minimum tax at all. Intent there is to make sure that at lower prices, we're not impacting companies when they're not making money. Because again, this is a profits tax only, but gets rid of the per barrel credits. And then here's the same thing for the GVR oil, getting rid of those per barrel credits. You can see the line is somewhere between the blue line, which is the status quo, and the old ACES, which is the red higher line. But one should also realize that one of the reported problems, or what the industry didn't like about ACES, was that when you change the tax rate, you changed it for all of the profits or all of the money that was earned from the first barrel up. And in what we're doing here, we have brackets. The progressivity brackets it's from that point forward. So if you had a 5% increase, that means at $40 and above you change, but all of the oil was lower, was that? So it's bracketed instead of on the full grid. So anyway, basically following up, this is our constitution. The legislature shall provide for the utilization, development, and conservation of all natural resources belonging to the state, including land and water, for the maximum benefit of the people. And so it's our it's our decision of what is the maximum benefit of the people. My view is that these large deficits that we have right now are from a tax system that is no longer working within the price range where it was. It was constructed for a much higher price range, and it's not working here for the maximum benefit of the people at all, and that we should reform our tax system so it goes back to the more normal one-third for the producers and two-thirds for the non-producers, and that would be to the state treasury and supporting the public services that we need. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Seaton. I think what I'd like to do, I think we could probably spend hours asking you questions, but we do have another presentation, and maybe what I'd like to do is bring Mr. Alper up and have him give his presentation, and then we won't be worried about asking you questions and then having enough time to get to the other presentation. So maybe if we could just ask members to write down your questions, and then we can be unrestrained after we have both presentations out. So with that, Mr. Alper, if you could come up and put yourself on the record and maybe start with your presentation.
Mr. Chairman, would it be okay to have a brief at ease to get my presentation spun up on the machinery here?
Did you say brief at ease?
Yes, please.
Brief at ease. House Finance is back on the record. And Mr. Alper, if you could put yourself on the record.
Good afternoon, good evening, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Ken Alper. I'm the Director of the Tax Division for the Alaska Department of Revenue, and I'm pleased to be here. Thank you for having us to help go into a little deeper detail on the committee's own bill, House Bill 411. My boss, the Commissioner of Revenue, will be joining me here in a few minutes. He is in a meeting down on the third floor, so I apologize for his absence at the beginning of the hearing. So just a little bit of background. How did we get here? What is the lay of the land on oil taxes? Alaska collects four major oil and gas revenue sources. The committee, for the most part, knows that. Some of this is for the viewers. We have a property tax, which is an ad valorem tax on the value of oil and gas assets, the pipelines, the fields, the wells, and so forth. That tax is shared with local governments, so the state does not get the lion's share of it. The royalty is the landowner's share. Well, we are fortunate as the state of Alaska that we happen to own the land where the bulk of our oil has been produced. That's unique among the oil-producing states, where most of the royalties are in private hands, and that benefit goes to individuals in Alaska state. The state of Alaska, the royalty goes to the state itself. The production tax, or sometimes called the severance tax, is our tax on the actual production of oil and severing it from the land. That's the net profits tax that Representative Seaton was describing in his introduction to the bill, and that's frankly of these four taxes where by far the most time in the legislature and anxiety and debate over what the tax should be has been focused on the production tax. And then we have a corporate income tax, like all other states. That's a share of corporate income that uses more traditional definitions of income, includes depreciation and so forth. And it's linked to the federal corporate income tax. It uses an apportionment formula tied to Alaska's share of certain global circumstances. I'm looking at a fan blade shadow on the screen. Our corporate income tax rate is 9.4%, but in recent years, the effective tax rate's been closer to 7%. Primarily because of these apportionment issues that we're a little bit less than average once you consider our property versus other states and so forth. So we're really talking about the production tax, but when you layer them all together, you can see what our revenue has looked like. And really in this one slide, Mr. Chairman, you can see why we've been debating budget cuts and permanent fund restructuring and other new revenue measures for the last several years. is because whereas as recently as 2012, our oil and gas unrestricted and restricted revenue was close to $10 billion, last year it was a little bit over $1 billion. That's a big decline, primarily driven by the change in the price of oil, also somewhat driven by the change in the oil tax itself that passed in 2014. You could see just by the colors, the blue, which is our royalty, has gone down, but maybe gone down by half, whereas the green, which is our production tax, has gone down by something over 90%. And in part, this is because it's a profits-based tax, and when the price dropped in half, the profits probably dropped by 90%. So the amount that we received through that tax got very thin indeed. And yes, we've seen a little bit of a rebound, and we're happy to see higher oil prices. Higher oil prices are generally good for the state's economy, but although our citizens do suffer for having to pay high fuel costs, for the most part, the state benefits from higher oil costs, but the creep back up doesn't nearly approach what they were some years ago. We're up to just about $2 billion, including restricted revenue. And restricted in the context of oil and gas, Mr. Chairman, what we're really talking about is the 25 or so percent of royalties that goes directly into the permanent fund corpus per the permanent fund sections of the Alaska Constitution. So we've had two recent bills that passed during, well, my tenure as the director of the tax division. I was part of both of these bills. In the 2016 session, House Bill 247 was primarily a tax credit bill. It phased out the Cook Inlet taxes. It reduced Middle Earth taxes. I believe all members know Middle Earth is a term of art in Alaska, meaning everything that's neither the North Slope nor Cook Inlet. It's the interior, it's Western Alaska, any place where there might be potential oil and gas resources. There's been some exploration thus far. There's been no commercial production of Middle Earth oil or gas in Alaska. That Bill 247 extended the Cook Inlet so-called tax cap. That was a hold harmless part of the original switch to net profits taxation in 2006. That was originally scheduled to go away in 2022, but was extended, and now it's eternal. And there's a new $1 tax per barrel on Cook Inlet oil, whereas that tax had formerly been zero. Probably the most important in the near-term revenue change is that the gross value reduction was changed. Instead of being a permanent benefit, it's now a benefit with a sunset, or we use the term graduation. New oil graduates and becomes old oil after some time between 3 and 7 years and starts paying the full tax rather than the so-called GVR, reduced tax. There's a cap on the amount of cash per company per year. That hasn't really come into play because of the limited amounts of cash appropriated to the actual cashable credit program. There was a resident hire priority added for when there is limited money and how you sort the people and who gets money first. Hire, local Alaskan hire, was given priority. A little bit of transparency, and I want to sort of pause there for a moment. That there is a report that we, the Department of Revenue, sent you and other legislators in March that detailed how much each company received in actual cash money in the year 2017. That is a bit of transparency, a specific waiver of confidentiality that became part of the law with this bill in 2016, and it's a very useful feature to understand just who's getting Alaska's money in the form of refundable tax credits. There was an interest rate change that I'm not going to dwell on because it was changed again the next year, a bunch of technical cleanup and a complex regulations package that occupied a good deal of my team's time in the fall of 2016 after the passage of the bill. 2017 now, this is last year, House Bill 111 was not the administration's bill. This one originated out of the House Resources Committee, although we certainly helped it along the way. And this is the bill that Co-Chair Seaton referred to as the bill that passed the House with a tax structure roughly resembling House Bill 411. The final version of the bill did not maintain those tax changes. It was the credit reform that had been in the Senate versions of the bill, but not the tax changes that had been in the House. But what that bill did, which was pretty historic and momentous for Alaska, was get us out of the idea of the issuing tax credits that are eligible for cash purchase. That's a thing that no longer is happening in Alaska. There is no so-called net operating loss credit. There are a handful of credits that remain eligible for cash, specifically the refinery credit and the LNG storage credit that's available to Fairbanks when they build their tank for the Interior Gas Utility. but those credits also sunset or expire in the next 2 or 3 years. So what we did was set up a new system of carried forward lease expenditures. We're no longer earning cash credits. Instead, a company's losses are held by that company, carried forward to be used in, against their taxes in a future year once they have production. To protect the state's interest from those being sold or used off lease, the idea of a ring fence was created, saying that when the field in question, until the field in question comes into production, the carry forwards associated with the development of that field can't be used. Once the field is in production, then they can be used, including to offset value from companies' other properties. The companies, meanwhile, have ultimate flexibility in how much of their carry forwards to use, how fast to use them, how much they want to lower their tax down as low as the 4% gross minimum tax, which I'll speak to in a little more in a little while. And finally, the idea of a downlift or a reduction in value of those lease expenditures. If a company can't use them for 10 years, they slowly start to erode in value and are worth less to the taxpayer. A few smaller changes from 111. There was the interest rate changes that had been changed in the previous bill got cleaned up a little further, and we were pleased to align the interest rate among all delinquent tax types. Now everyone, whether they're delinquent on their oil and gas tax or their fish tax, is paying the same interest rate to the state of Alaska. And it adjusts quarterly. It's compound interest. It fixed a lot of problems that had accrued over a couple of years. A new provision that allows credits to be used backwards in time against prior year taxes, so long as there's not a hook to where the revenue of that past year belongs to the Constitutional Budget Reserve. And I can delve into that if there's questions. Suffice to say, credits used to only be able to be used against current and future years. Now they could be used backwards, and there's a little bit of a window where there's some past year tax liability related to the TAP settlement that we expect to see paid by the purchase of other people's tax credits. Meanwhile, we created conditional exploration credits. What does that mean? Some of the folks waiting for exploration credits, it takes a while to review them. It's a complex process. It's a final audit. And they felt like they were being left behind in the payment line. So we give them what amounts to a coupon, a place in line while they're waiting to get their credits finalized so they don't lose their spot. In Middle Earth, those who are still earning exploration credits could offset their corporate income tax with it. There is a delayed repeal, meaning once we've paid off all of our credits, which we anticipate will happen under normal circumstances in 5 or 6 years, the tax credit fund would fully repeal and go away at 1 year later. There's other legislation in this building related to the purchase of old tax credits through a bonding mechanism. Should that pass, it would probably expedite the repeal of the tax credit fund in a nearer term. And then the legislative working group, and the Chair Seaton alluded to that. That's the group that should be working on ongoing and continuing issues of oil and gas taxation. What are the remaining points of purchase and conflict, and how could we best provide a tax that provides a fair share for Alaskans and a stable investing environment for industry at the same time? Ultimately, that's the goal of these working groups. So let's get to the bill itself, the bill analysis, House Bill 411. The two bills I just described took a lot of time. They were complicated. They had many parts to them, but they didn't really touch the tax itself. They really delved in the issue of tax credits and the cashable credit regime. They did not touch the core tax components that were set in place by the main structural legislation of 2013, Senate Bill 21. The core provisions of our current production tax are a 35% tax on net or production tax value or profit, or at least a reasonable proxy for profit, reduced by a 0 to 8 per dollar per barrel sliding scale credit that Chair Seaton alluded to. That's a non-cashable credit. That's different than the credits we got rid of last year. Those could be used to reduce taxes, but they can't be carried forward. They can't be cashed. They are a use-it-or-lose-it credit. The gross value reduction, reducing the taxable value by 20% if the oil meets a new oil definition for the period of time that it's allowed. And the new oil tax had a different credit instead of the sliding scale, a fixed $5 per barrel credit. SB 21 maintained a 4% floor or minimum tax tied to gross value that had been carried forward from the previous tax legislation, ACES. So what we really have is a higher of calculation. The net calculation is your net times 35% minus the 8 at low prices, or the gross or wellhead value times 4%. Whichever is the higher of those numbers is the tax that's paid for legacy oil. So that's our tax system that this bill looks to amend. 411 doesn't do that much. It really does three things. It reduces the tax itself from 35 to 25%, and then it adds these brackets or progressivity that change the rate from 25 to 35 and 40 on that portion of the profits above the threshold numbers, and eliminates the two per barrel credits, both the 0-8 legacy oil credit and the $5 new oil credit. It does not touch the GVR in any way, and it does not touch the minimum tax rate in any way, although it does change at what price points the minimum tax applies. Essentially, the minimum tax kicks in at a much lower price point than it does under current law, and we'll see some of the graphic slides a little down the road that show that. So initial observations, just sort of qualitatively looking at the bill and what did we think mathematically when we saw it. It is very similar to a bill that this committee already reviewed, this same finance committee in the last session that passed on and went to the House and passed as part of the House's version of House Bill 111. If you were to strip the credit sections that ended up passing into law out of the House's bill, what you would find left is very similar to House Bill 411. There's slight differences in the tax brackets, as Chair Seaton said, and the previous bill from last year did not eliminate the $5 per barrel credit for the gross value reduction oil, although I sense that was more of an oversight than a conscious decision in that version of the bill. The revenue impact, as with the bill last year, is concentrated at these low moderate price ranges, the $50 to $90 oil prices. It has a lower tax increase as prices get higher. It's concentrated here, and it reduces, and I said this a moment ago, reduces the impact of the minimum tax because of the so-called crossover point. Right now, the crossover point is in the 60s. Last year, it was in the 70s. With the passage of this bill, it would go down into the low 40s, meaning the minimum tax would only matter at $40 oil and below. There is a tax increase for the GVR eligible oil, for the new oil, and the reason is under current law, when oil is eligible for the GVR at low prices, it tends to pay zero tax because that $5 credit for a new producer, there's issues of a legacy producer's new oil that we won't go into here, but for a new producer, they pay zero at prices below about $70 a barrel. That would no longer occur with this bill because there is no $5 credit to reduce the tax below the minimum tax. That 4% tax would apply to the GVR oil, and we'll see that in the graphs. The tax brackets are different, very different than what we saw in the past as ACEs. A lot of the pushback, a lot of the debate for the several years it took the legislature to unwind the ACEs tax system, it passed in 2007, it was repealed in 2013, had to do with the progressivity. And the issue with ACEs progressivity was as your profits went up, your tax rate went up on all of your profits. So that highest tax rate applied to every dollar of oil profits. And if you can imagine the curves there, it resulted in a very high marginal tax rate, meaning there was a condition where you might earn one more dollar, and because that dollar would raise the per barrel profitability on every dollar that you earned, you would end up paying another 80 or 85 cents in taxes on one additional dollar in prices. Now, that calculation worked in reverse. If you invested an extra dollar, you could save 80 cents on your taxes, but still, that high marginal rate was a point of a great anxiety for industry and was one of the reasons ACEs was ultimately repealed. The brackets in this bill are absolutely different than that. They are very mathematically different and structurally different. They only charge the higher rate on the portion of the profits that are above the cutoff number. So in the case of this bill, the first $40 of profit only ever pay the 25% rate. Only that 41st dollar of profit is taxed at a rate higher than 25%. In this case, 30%. That means the marginal tax rate impacts are much lower. A similar bracketed bill did work its way through the House of Representatives, Mr. Chairman, for those of your members who were here then. In 2011, that was Governor Parnell's first major attempt to reduce the tax rate with a bill called HB 110. That bill passed the House, did not pass the Senate, and it also had bracketed progressivity as part of its structure. One thing I want to point out for the committee, and I don't know if it was the intent, but my staff identified this, your tax brackets here are tied to BTU equivalent barrels or BOE, barrels of oil equivalent. That means if we started getting major gas production, you would actually be reducing your average value of the oil, and you would see a dilution of your value that could lead to an unintended tax rate reduction. You might recall the decoupling conversation of the 2010 session. We could put ourselves into another decoupling problem if the progressivity brackets remain tied to a BTU equivalent value. And if you wanted to go in that direction, we would recommend you limit that to the oil only. I heard of one member on the House floor mention the length of the bill. I wouldn't get too hung up on that. Oil bills tend to be long because there's a lot of interlinked sections and conforming language. 21 out of the 25 pages in front of you are purely conforming language, technical edits that it takes simply to implement the real changes to the law that are in the other four pages of the bill. Those technical changes relate to the calculation of monthly estimated tax payments and the physical calculation of production tax value for the purpose of calculating the tax, not the tax sections themselves. So I just wanted to point to that. Again, initial observations. Mr. Chairman, this is the table on the fiscal note. It's actually a bit of an update to that table. I'll point out the new lines, and it's sort of annotated on the right. There's a lot of data here, and a lot of members aren't used to reading data-heavy, dense tables, so I just want to sort of walk the members through it. The top sections, the lines numbered 1 through 4, attempt to break the bill into its component parts and say, what is the actual fiscal impact of each of the subsections of the bill in each of the next 10 years at the estimated forecast price from the Department of Revenue? And you could see both negatives and positives in there. Line one is a negative number because we are lowering the tax rate from 35 to 25, and that means that there's less revenue on that one component. However, we're getting rid of the per barrel credit, meaning that is a subtraction no longer available to be reducing taxes. So that's the large positive number on line two. Line four is more or less the when you start doing multiple things at the same time, the impact of doing them together reduces the impact of the one. And so the total revenue impact there, that gray line that starts with a 788, that is the fiscal note revenue number, how much new revenue comes from this bill. Chair Seaton mentioned this in his presentation. That number differs a little bit from what was on that more stylized model that we provided the committee last week. That model was based on an average producer and an average barrel and an average cost. Once our modeling digs in a little deeper, it goes into the specific circumstances of each of the company. Each has their own cost profile. Generally speaking, some of the major producers have a lower cost profile than the average, which means they're a little bit more profitable, which means their taxes are going to be higher when you raise the taxes. So we're seeing fiscal note impacts more in the $700 million range rather than the $600 million range in a model when you're looking at simply the so-called average barrel. So that's the total revenue change identified in yellow. And then the section below that, and this is the new information that's not in our fiscal note, but should the bill move on or should you desire us to amend it, we could add that to the fiscal note. It's a feature we had in the bills last year, putting a value to the carried forward losses. This is the new concept I spoke to earlier. We formerly had NOL credits. We now carry forward losses. How much are those losses worth? Well, they're worth the amount that you carried forward multiplied by the tax rate. Because we're reducing the tax rate, the value of those losses, two companies to offset future taxes, gets reduced by roughly 2/7, the difference between 35 and 25%. And you can see that tracked in that bar called change in value of carried forward expenditures. And finally, that very dense series of bars on the very bottom. What you're looking at there is every cluster of bars next to a price point, let's focus on the 60 for a minute, represents a year. So you've got an FY19, 20, 21 in skinny little bars all the way up to 28. If the price of oil was $60 that year, if the price of oil was $80 that year, and so forth. And you could see stylistically here, the bill has very little, if any, impact at $20 or $40 oil. The most impact at $60 or $80 oil, and it starts to decline at higher prices, in line with what I said in my introductory remarks. The FC on the left-hand side of that table stands for forecast. That's the Department of Revenue's official forecast oil price, which is $63 next year and creeping up to about $75 at the end of the forecast period. So it's a number that's somewhere in between the $60 and $80 bars for the 10-year period. So I'm now on slide 13. Slide 13 does a similar revenue impact comparison, and I'm not going to go too deeply into this one in that I can only talk so much, Mr. Chairman. But this is the tax calculation at a range of prices using the FY19 data and how the tax comparison compares to the minimum tax, sort of where's the higher of. So I'll draw the committee's attention to a couple of lines here. You can see as the price goes up, the costs are presumed to be fixed. That is frankly not entirely correct, as if the price of oil increases, costs tend to increase with it, but this is shown mainly for illustrative purposes. You get to the PTV, or the net, that's multiplied by the 35% tax, and then the per barrel credit. Now, the per barrel credit, you'll see, is 8888888 and then 7654. That alludes to what Chair Seaton said before as well, that per barrel credit starts at zero at a roughly $160 oil and adds a dollar every time the price of oil drops $10 below that. At the price we've been in for the last few years, roughly below about $90 a barrel, it is the full $8 credit. So you get the net tax by subtracting that from the tax, and then you compare that to the 4% minimum tax, which is 4% of the line called GVPP, and then the higher of is what is paid in taxes. So you have the existing calculation, and then you go to the proposed taxation. The proposed is different because you've got a 25% tax. So for the most part, the tax labeled tax at 25% will be a smaller number than about six lines above it, tax at 35%. But then you have these bracketed taxes or progressive taxes that kick in at $80 oil and become more substantial at higher prices. And that means the larger tax, especially when the per barrel credit is no longer there. And then converting that to the actual revenue impact on the bottom line, those are the numbers from the fiscal note analysis. The other way to do that would be to take the proposed tax minus the existing tax and multiply them by 170 million roughly, which is the number of taxable barrels expected to be produced next year. But order of magnitude, you can see the revenue impact at a wide range of prices. Let's get away from numbers and look at visuals. I think everyone prefers looking at graphs. This is the same information in graphical form. You can see the status quo blue line versus the bill before you as a green line. The wiggles to the right-hand side of the blue line are where each of the per barrel credit steps leap up. So you can see the 8 goes to the 7, goes to the 6, goes to the 5 as you work your way to the right. And because of that, the delta, the tax increase between the two lines, tends to shrink as you get further out in the price range. And the biggest revenue impact is in that $50, $60, $70, $80 price range that we're looking at in the left center of the screen. I'm going to sort of pause here for a second, because this graph is looking at the same information with a different lens as slide 15, the slide after. This slide was in the chairman's presentation. Setting aside the ACES line for a minute, the blue line and the green line on this graph are the same as the blue line and the green line on this graph, with the difference being whereas slide 14 is looking at revenue, and revenue increases with the price of oil regardless, slide 15 is looking at effective tax rate. Effective tax rate means what percentage of the profit comes to the state in a tax after all credits. So in the status quo, that number tends to get smaller until you trigger the minimum tax at about $65 a barrel, and then it starts going up again as prices get lower, as companies' profits are constrained and they're still paying a tax based on gross. The new green line, meanwhile, smooths out that line where they're paying a fixed 25% net tax with no offsets, So it's a straight up 25% effective tax rate. And then the line kind of creeps up gradually as those new brackets kick in the 70s and then again the 80s and the 90s. So again, it's the same data looked at differently, revenue versus effective tax rate. And then slide 16 is the same as 15, only now we're looking at the gross value reduction oil. Now the big changes between 15 and 16 really are in the status quo. With a gross value reduction, the revenue curve tends to be lower at all price points, but it goes to zero at low oil. You see that, how the blue line goes to zero at the and with GVR, but it's not with the legacy oil. That's because the tax code allows that $5 credit to not be tied to the floor, so it could reduce taxes to zero. Meanwhile, if that per barrel credit were repealed, eliminated, as envisioned by House Bill 411, the minimum tax would kick in, and you could see that tail going up to the left side of the green line. That's where the minimum tax kicks in for gross value reduction eligible oil under this bill. Revenue-wise, you could see you're more or less splitting the difference between the old tax code and the new, tending towards the bottom end of the range of the difference between the two. So that's the math. Now to the discussion. What does it all mean? So let's put this in context. House Bill 111 created a working group to look at the outstanding issues. There has not really been substantial meetings, has not offered any suggestions. The working group is 10 legislators, and it has attached to it an advisory panel. The advisory panel is another group created by prior legislation called the Competitiveness Review Board. That was put in place as part of Senate Bill 21 in 2013, and it's administration people, industry people who are intended to be meeting to talk about Alaska's place in global competitiveness. Full disclosure, I'm a member of that advisory committee in the seat offered to the Commissioner of Revenue, who's designated me to be his designee for that role. But it has not really met this year. Meanwhile, LBNA, Legislative Budget and Audit, has hired three new consultants specifically to analyze our tax system and model and offer suggestions, and only one of the three has been here, provided some general information on background, but has not been substantial conversations on what's up with our tax system that I think was the expectation when these three consultants were hired. So we're awaiting information. And meanwhile, the administration introduced our own bill specifically for the purpose of dealing with the remaining balance of cashable tax credits, the so-called bonding bill. That bill passed out of the Resources Committee this morning and may have been read to the Finance Committee today on the House floor. I wasn't paying attention, but we hope to see it in this committee soon. As far as the remaining tax issues, we've identified some other issues. The advisory committee is supposed to look at certain other issues, and the next slide lists them. But again, these are just ideas that could be addressed by the committee and the consultants. So I've tried to color code this a little bit. The blue ones are in the administration's bill. That's House Bill 331, the bonding bill. We have these outstanding tax credits. There's 800 million of them on the street. We're no longer making open-ended purchases. We have to figure out how to clear that debt at some point. There's others pending. We'll be at around 950 million by the end of credits. In doing so, we've created some imbalances between the new producers and the legacy producers, because the legacy producers can offset their costs in many cases against their current spending, whereas the companies that incur losses when they're developing, they can't monetize those losses. How do we maintain equity? Well, buying back these credits would be a step in that direction. The green ones are issues that are impacted by the bill before you, the ongoing debate on what is Alaska's fair share, and I would imagine with 11 members of this committee, there are 11 different opinions at least as to what is Alaska's fair share, and that's why we have these conversations. An issue that we spoke to last year in the debates on 111 is the imbalance between the 35% nominal tax rate, which means companies reduce their tax by 35 cents when they spend a dollar, whereas the actual effective tax rate, which could be 10 or 15% or less, at low profit levels. So that misalignment leads to some unusual economic conditions. And again, this bill, whatever one thinks of the bill, does resolve that issue. It aligns the marginal tax rate with the effective tax rate across all prices. There was also the issue of very large future offsets in the past, large future credits. We've been fortunate to have major new discoveries. Those major new discoveries will cost literally billions of dollars to develop. And ultimately, Alaska is going to have to deal with the issue of those large carried forward losses and what that means on the taxes on those future fields. Issues that are also on the table but not in the bill before you and not in the administration's bill, there really isn't the systematic mechanism to have a big surplus when the price of oil spikes. There is no way to replenish the surpluses, replenish the savings balances if the price of oil goes up to $120, $30 for a couple of months because something catastrophic happens on the other side of the world. Alaska does not reap that benefit the way they would have a few years ago. The Cook Inlet tax cap may not be sustainable in the long run. We've got a major development basin, a major resource basin that pays very little taxes, although is also no longer receiving credits. And look, net profits taxes are complicated. We've had to build up a lot of functionality to deal with this. The many changes and the many amendments are wrenching to the system, and it's just a complicated process and something that we always need to mention when we're looking at additional changes to the system. So the next couple of slides, Mr. Chairman, are trying to highlight, and I like to think of these as the pros and cons slides, and each of these could sort of be taken a different way. There's a, you know, on the one hand and then on the other hand, there's a reason why a tax like this might be a good idea. There's a reason that we might want to give you some pause. And our role here really is to do both, is just sort of put the issues before the committee and help point out what we're able to observe from our role at the Department of Revenue. Now, the one reality is oil industry profitability really is up dramatically in the last 18 months because primarily the price of oil is a little bit higher. Also, companies have restrained their spending as a reaction to lower prices in the past couple of years, and also to a certain extent the production has also increased. The production forecasts have gone up. So based on all of those little features, in the fall 16 revenue sources book that was published in, well, the fall of 2016, about a year and a half ago, we were looking at $60 oil for this coming year with 442,000 barrels a day and an estimated profit for companies of $1.8 billion. Now, PTV is it's sort of a halfway point along the profit calculation. By no means is that any company's take home. That is where that's after they paid all the royalties, it's after they believe they paid their property tax, but before the production tax and any state or local income taxes. But that's a measure of divisible income. The production tax we were forecasting for 2019, a year and a half ago, was $248 million, an effective tax rate of 13.9%, and the statutory credit calculation is going to be $54 million. Well, now we're looking at higher prices, $63, with more production, $526,000, and lower costs. And the big key there is lower costs. And industry profitability is $4.7 billion estimated next year, $2.9 billion more than we were looking at for the same year a year and a half ago. But based on that additional profitability, the production tax is only $410 million. It's only $162 million more for a lower effective tax rate, 8.7%. Now I'm going to sort of pause and slide back a few and go back to this graph. What we're doing is going down the tail on the left side here. There's high effective tax rates at lower prices because the minimum tax dominates. As we work closer to the crossover point, we actually get a lower effective tax rate, and that's what we're seeing in the latest forecast. Meanwhile, the statutory credit calculation, and I know members of this committee strongly disagree with our interpretation there, but using the same apples-to-apples mechanism as I did 5 minutes ago in the earlier section, is up to $184 million, or $130 million more credit calculation, whereas there's only $162 million more in production tax forecast. So there are some imbalances here. There's stuff worth looking at, without question, because of where we happen to fall on the profit curve. On the other, we are taxing lower than in the past. A similar version of this slide was in the chairman's presentation. The ELF rate was an unusual formula tied to the per well productivity, how many barrels you got per well that you drilled. What happened over time as production declined even a little bit from the large fields, and companies did more infill drilling and field drilling, all the old wells still counted in the formula, so the per well productivity went down and the tax rates went down with them. And they went down steadily. There was a little bit of an uptick between 04 and 06 that had to do with when Governor Murkowski aggregated the Prudhoe Bay satellites into the main Prudhoe Bay field and scooped up a little bit of revenue there, and that increased the effective average ELF rate. But whatever those numbers are, since 2015, we've been pretty well locked into a 4% effective gross tax rate using the same scale as those numbers. Under 411, companies would pay more than that 4% at prices above about $40. So there's another metric to look at. But we also have to realistically look at the metric of stability. Alaska has developed a reputation of changing its taxes often. I don't need to read all of these. Many of you were here for all of them. Number one was what I just mentioned, the ELF aggregation. That was actually an executive order, not a bill. The other six of those were bills that passed the legislature that were substantive changes to the production tax and credit system, starting with PPT, ACEs, the Cook Inlet Recovery Act, the Cook Inlet Credits, SB 21, and then the two more recent bills that I went into greater detail in earlier in the presentation, all in the last 13 years. And this would be, and I'm certain when you're having invited testimony from industry, they will all mention that this would be the eighth change in a 13-year period. So I might as well put it on the table. It's fact, and it's something we need to contemplate. Now, one thing that's harder to identify that we are just starting to scratch the surface of modeling in the limited time we've had access to this bill is how this would impact the future projects. With the world of carry-forwards and how the carry-forwards are used to offset future value, it's different now than it was under credits. And we have to really adapt our modeling to contemplate what's really going on when you change the taxes underneath the carry-forwards. So HB 111 eliminated the credits. They could be used to reduce your taxes, but you could only reduce them down to your minimum tax, and then for the GVR period, you could go to zero. And again, once the GVR goes away, you can't go below the floor. But what that really means is, let's say, and I mentioned it a while ago, you spend $5 billion building a giant new tax field, oil field, and then you start producing oil. The price of oil could be $100 a barrel, and you're still going to pay the minimum tax for a while. And that's an important thing for everyone to understand. You're going to use up all of your carry forwards to reduce the value, no matter how much value there is, until you get that value down to the amount that's the equivalent of a minimum tax payment. That's sort of baked into the new system. The real variable is tied to the price of oil. How many years is it going to take you to do that? Is the price so high that you get through all your costs in 3 years, or is the price kind of marginal and you get through all your costs in 10 or 12 years? And when you're changing the tax underneath that, you're going to change some of that time clock, which means you're going to change the number of years that the company is going to be able to claim the minimum tax in these sort of future field modeling. The other thing that's happening here, which I said before when talking about the GVR, is that you're paying higher taxes in those early years because there's no longer the ability to pay zero when you're under the gross value reduction. And that's going to increase the taxes in those early years of production, which is going to change the rate of return type economic modeling, the return on investment modeling that companies do. And it's also going to stretch out the timeline where it might take companies more years to use up their carry forwards because they couldn't use them during those early years when they were paying the higher minimum tax. Meanwhile, so all of these variables work in concert, and they're hard to explain. And if we want to go deeper into that, I have my modeler who could come in and speak to the committee at another time if that's appropriate. But boiling all of that down, we have our so-called life cycle analysis, and you've seen some of these graphs. I'm on slide 25 now. This is an analysis of the 40 years of modeled investment and production for a new large field of 750 million barrels that peaks at 120,000 barrels per day of production. It is not specifically modeled on sort of the Armstrong field, although it is in some ways has similar characteristics to it. In order of magnitude, it's good to sort of understand what does a large field look like. We ran that field through the model. How much do you spend developing it? How do you recapture those costs? what taxes and royalties and other state and federal taxes do you pay after that, and then what does your cash flow and discounted cash flow and rate of return look like? And what did we learn? Well, it depends on the price of oil, but sticking with the forecast price, if the price of oil actually lines up perfectly with our forecast for the next 40 years, the actual production tax paid by companies is going to be $1.9 billion higher, between $6.4 and then $8.3 billion. That's material. Another important metric is the producer internal rate of return. Now, that's one of those economic terms that makes a lot of normal people glaze over, and I respect your ability to do that. To put that in layman's terms, the internal rate of return is the discount rate at which your net present value goes to zero. So in other words, if you look at future cash flow and you look at the time value of money, how much are you discounting that time value of money? There's a difference if money is worth 5% more to you per year versus 10% more to you per year. And it roughly equates to, if I didn't bother to do this and I just sort of put my money in a bank earning this much money, where am I at the same place with my investment? So the difference is, with this bill, the rate of return drops by about half a percentage point. That the company's rate of return at the forecast price would drop from 7.9 to 7.4. If we have a world of $80 oil, it would drop from 11.4 to 10.8. So from the company's point of view, their ability to withstand risk is a little bit worse because they've lost about half a percent of their upside. Converted to language that lay people can better understand, what's the break-even price? What is the dollar value of a barrel of oil if they presume a 10% discount rate that they're breaking even? And this bill increases a project's break-even price from $72 to $75, or about a $3 increase. So that's roughly the aggregate economic impacts of the bill before you. So, in conclusion, and I'm looking behind me and I see Commissioner Fisher, and if you don't mind, Mr. Chairman, I'd like him to join me for this portion of the presentation.
Commissioner Fisher, if you could put yourself on the record.
Thank you. My name is Sheldon Fisher. I'm the Commissioner for the Department of Revenue. Thank you. I just wanted to, there's only a couple slides left, but I wanted to talk a little bit about how we, in terms of the administration, are thinking about this. And I've stolen two slides out of Commissioner Navarro's presentation that I think he gave earlier during session. And this first shows the nominal gross domestic product from all non-petroleum segments in the economy. And what you can see there is that, to a large extent, no single segment dominates, but when you add them all together, they sum up to a meaningful contribution. In 2015, it was a little over $3.5 billion. When you look at this, and again, this is from Commissioner Navarro's presentation, so he took the history of over the last 20 years or more in terms of oil and gas production and GDP, and that's that kind of burnt orange line. And underneath that, the blue line shows the total unrestricted general funds, and then the kind of grayish line is the unrestricted petroleum revenue. And what you see there is that over time, and you all know this very well, that far and away the bulk of our unrestricted revenue comes from petroleum revenue. And back in the 70s and 80s, when petroleum was the bulk of the state GDP, that may have been appropriate correct or a reasonable approach to taxation. But since that period of time, as you can see, the other private industries have grown substantially, and yet we as a state have not diversified our revenues. And so this is kind of setting up a viewpoint that we want to express, which is that Director Alper discussed a moment ago the number of changes that we've had in our tax regime, our oil tax regime, over the last number of years. And I guess I do believe, and from my vantage point, that I think that uncertainty does create challenges to attracting future investment and minimizes, I think, or diminishes the investment that we otherwise could have. And it's my view that we would be better off as a state if we can have this conversation around oil, a refinement of our oil tax regime in an environment where oil isn't the only industry that we're looking to fund state needs. And so kind of thinking about our fiscal challenges that we face as a state, we are hopeful, optimistic, that the state is close to being able to come up with a partial fiscal plan where we'll begin to use permanent fund earnings in a structured way, and that will close a substantial part of the gap. There will still be a material gap of $500 to $700 million that is missing from our in terms of a deficit. But we believe that the most appropriate first step to take is to look to a broad-based tax, which is a proxy or a way of addressing all of those other industries that today contribute a very modest amount. And so looking at a broad-based tax as a way of filling that gap and providing more of a balance or fairness to all of the different industries that make up the state GDP. And then with those steps taken, we can then look at whether or not changes to the oil and gas tax regime is appropriate. It will give the consultants and the process that the legislature has defined in terms of gathering more information and getting some professional advice in terms of how we stand from a competitive perspective on a worldwide basis. And we believe that that will ultimately result in a more stable tax regime, both in the oil industry and for the state as a whole. And I think that concludes. There's no more slides, right? So, yep, that concludes my remarks, and if there's any questions.
Great, thank you. And I just want to let folks know, also available for questions, we have Rob Carpenter from Legislative Finance. He's here in the room. Jim Beckham from the Department of Natural Resources, and also Emily Naumann from Legislative Legal. They're online. And then, of course, we have Commissioner Fisher and Mr. Alper. And with that, I have questions from Representative Gren, and then Guerra, and then Pruitt.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, and Mr. Alper and Commissioner, welcome. Thank you for the presentation. And clear and honest and thorough, so I appreciate that. And congratulations, Commissioner.
Thank you.
I voted for you. I know we have a few days, obviously, regarding 441, and I know we're going to get into some details and some modeling. So I was just trying to get more, perhaps, some clarifying questions and a larger kind of viewpoint from where you guys sit on this. So let me start with page 29, the last bullet points, where it says it may be premature to address substantial tax revision. It kind of it goes back to your slide regarding the unstable tax environment that we've set up, perhaps with the 7 changes in the past 13 years. This would be 8 moving forward. So when someone asks me, Representative Gren, how substantial is this change, scale of 1 to 10, what perhaps should I tell them compared to our current, our status quo, to what we're moving and on to? Use the word substantial, so I'm just trying to kind of qualify that in a simpler term, I guess.
Through the chair, Representative Gren, I've never been asked the 1 to 10 question before, but I'm going to go back to this slide right here, which is the, sort of the effective tax rate. And let's just to calibrate this scale. Let's say the switch to SB 21 was a 10, right, which was momentous and historic and controversial. There was a referendum, a statewide effort to. This is probably about a 6 as far as going back in the other direction.
So day 84, 6 on a scale of 1 to 10 of a change in our tax structure.
I would even, if I may, this is Commissioner Fisher, I would just kind of highlight the difference at the price points we're talking about, which are in the mid-60s. If you're an oil company, that's a pretty substantial difference between where the blue line is below 10 to where the green line is. I think that's a pretty substantial change.
You referenced a few times, Mr. Alper, regarding another bill. And since you referenced it, I guess I will as well, that passed out of Senate or House Resources today, House Bill 331. Looking at these, I guess, on as signals to investors and companies, if we put 331 and 411 together, if they both passed, both became law, what signal would that, what does that say about our environment up here, our oil and gas tax structure?
So maybe I'll take that. I think that that's the point of my testimony is that we think that it's I think everyone here appreciates that the oil industry has been a tremendous part of the state, has funded our roads and our schools and all of the things we do, and I think we believe that it's important to have this conversation around whether or not that tax regime needs to change in an environment that doesn't necessarily have the pressure of a billion, $2 billion deficit that we're trying to fill, where the industry, I think, often feels like whenever we have a challenge, there's one place we go, and there's only one solution to the issue. And so, our view is we ought to deal with our fiscal issue first through the POMV, second through a broad-based tax, and then with maybe a little bit less pressure on all of us, have a very structured, well-informed discussion around what an appropriate regime ought to look like, and do that in a way that I think will inspire and instill confidence rather than create an impression that we'll just, whatever challenge we have, we're going to be making changes to that one tax regime to solve the issue.
Can I add something to that, Mr. Chairman? The Governor's Bill 331 is really about addressing an immediate need. You've got companies who have been exploring, for the most part, have discovered an oil resource, and they would like to develop it, and they're hung up. They're high-centered. They're locked out of credit markets because they're delinquent on debt, in part because of this tax credit issue that slowed them down over the last couple of years. So the initial purpose is to clear their balance sheets so they can start investing again. Then they need to make the decision to go forward and develop their fields in Alaska, and that's where they'll be looking to the tax system. Right now, the tax system doesn't matter to them if they're not doing anything. Now, I honestly don't believe that the companies in question think that the current tax system will remain in place for the next 20 years. I don't think that is a realistic expectation of anybody. And I think that in my commentary on this bill, I pointed out, and many others could do so, concerns or shortcomings with the current tax that in some way will likely be addressed once we have the attention to bear on that issue and we could really together discuss a sustainable way forward. I think what causes them the most anxiety is not so much this tax or the next tax change, but what the counter move might be and what the tax change after that is. And I think the real goal should be to get something that can get something close to a consensus opinion that could be stable for more than a handful of years so that they can actually make those investments and develop those resources that we help them through our credit system to discover, so that we could all benefit from the fruits of that production and those jobs and those taxes.
Follow up one last.
Follow up
on slide 18 regarding the ongoing activities. How do you translate that the working group that was created with 111 has not had any substantive meetings yet, and of the three consultants that have been hired, there's only been one presentation to the legislature? How do you translate that, those activities?
So it's a sequence of events through the chair, Representative Gren. The working group intended to be created shortly after the last legislative session. You all know, as legislators, that went on longer than anyone might have preferred, deep into last fall. In the middle of all that, there was a hurricane that left Houston underwater. That's where many of the consultants are located. There was an early attempt to get a working group together in Houston with the consultants that had to get canceled because their offices were all closed. And then suddenly this fall special session was being scheduled and that window had been lost. So there was that. But in this session, we really haven't been talking that much about oil and gas. We've been talking about the budget and the permanent fund, and there hasn't been the energy. I would like to be able to say when that's going to happen and when the focus will be brought to bear. There have been a couple of reasons for delay, but eventually we really need to get these groups together.
Thank you, Representative Guerra, and then Pruitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I appreciate you being here. Director Alper, thank you. I just want to distill some things. First of all, I think it is politely saying false to talk about all the tax changes in the last 10 years. So let's go to page 22 and distill this so we're not giving the public a false impression. Let's go through the last 10 years of these supposed tax changes. On page 22, in 2010, we gave the oil companies money. So I don't think they're complaining about that. And in 2013, we gave the oil companies money, and they campaigned for an oil tax that they liked very much. So the first two changes were ones that oil companies liked. The ones in 2016 and 2017 had nothing to do with taxes. They had to do with an unsustainable tax credit program that almost everybody said was unsustainable. And we replaced that with something that this legislature agreed was sustainable. So for the last 10 years, I mean, I heard you come here, Commissioner, and say that we don't want all of this instability that we've had in the last 10 years, the last few years, you said. But all of it has been either in the industry's favor or has had nothing to do with taxes. So I don't think it attracts investment here to publicly talk about instability that has benefited the oil industry or has had nothing to do with taxes. I mean, what do you have to say about that? I mean, the instability is, if I'm an oil company, I love it.
Through the chair. Maybe just, you know, I once worked for someone who said where you sit, where you stand depends on where you sit. And I got to tell you, where I sit, I regularly hear a degree of frustration about the uncertainty around our oil tax regime. And I just want to echo what Director Alper said a moment ago. The next time we change it, I think our goal should be to change something and to develop something that we believe will be sustainable for decades to come. And I think that the best way to do that is in an environment where the budgetary pressures have been lessened. They're never going to be eliminated, but they've been lessened. And we can get the relevant information that allows us to have a very careful, studied approach and result in something that is as close to a consensus as we can achieve.
Thank you. Through the chair.
Representative Guerra.
I guess so. I guess we hang out with different people because there has not been a single tax increase in the last 10 years that the oil industry did not want. So, but I guess my constituents disagree. Let's talk about your issue about whether we're having a well-informed discussion. Can we go to page 16 of the tax slide? I would say one of the reasons, Commissioner, and I'd like to hear your comment on this, if any field in Anwar, the fields that we've always wanted to open for so long, if any field in Anwar started today at prices roughly where we are today. They would pay either no production taxes at all for 7 years, or maybe 3 or 4% in production taxes. Do you maybe understand why some of us are concerned about the current tax system?
Through the chair, I do understand that there is a concern about the current tax system, and I don't want to suggest. I mean, I think that this administration has acknowledged some concern. But the bigger issue, I think, is the framework in which we're going to have that discussion and the end goal. And I think that the position of the administration is this is not the time to have that, to try to resolve the issues associated with the oil tax regime, and that we ought to do it in a different framework where we can settle on a regime that we believe will be sustainable on a long-term basis.
Thank you. Through the chair.
Representative Garrett.
So there have been a lot of complex terms thrown around, and oil and gas taxes tend to be complex. But to be distilled pretty simply, the current system we have right now for what we call new oil, fields in Anwar, no production taxes at all for the first 7 years at any oil price at $60 and below. So no matter how profitable you are, you don't pay the state any production taxes. And if oil prices are at $70 a barrel, they pay about an 8% profits tax, which is maybe one of the lowest in the world. That's for new oil. Can you go to page 15, please? For highly profitable oil, fields like Prudhoe Bay, our legacy fields, we have a system that at today's prices, we charge roughly an 8% tax on profits. Again, one of the lowest oil taxes in the world. You can add in our royalties. Our royalties are lower than any of the royalties in the major oil-producing states in the United States. But the production tax, about 8% on the existing fields that we have on the North Slope, you'd agree that's pretty low, 8% of profits. Would you agree that's pretty low, or do you think that's great?
I don't want to say I think that's great. But I think that we have to look at this, we have to look at our property tax on top of it, we have to look at the royalties, and we have to compare all of that as a package compared to other jurisdictions. And I think that we believe that this is not the right time to be having that debate.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Garrett got us on slide 15, and I just sort of want to point to something that's on the slide, again, with the per-barrel credit. Look at this segment of the line. I'm using my cursor here. Is it showing up? That's the $5 line. A decision was made late in the 2013 session in the progress of House Bill 21. The bill that came over was a Senate bill, had a flat $5 per-barrel credit in it, and that passed that body. And it was only like a week from the end of session that this sliding scale got added to the mix. Had that version of the bill stayed, if you could sort of imagine the projection of this line, both to the right, where it's lower, and to the left, where it's higher, it would have come in somewhere around here. So Alaska kind of gambled that prices would be high and we would pick up this increment, but we sort of lost that gamble because prices were low, and we ended up here instead of here. So that the difference between that $5 and that $8 credit is absolutely material in the prices that we've seen for the last several years, and I don't know if we'd be looking at the same degree of anxiety had the Senate's version of the bill made it to the finish line.
Through the chair, just one final.
Sure, Representative Guerra.
Thank you, and that's really part of the point. I mean, there are two types of oil taxes that we've been taught over the years by experts that are very unstable: those that are too high and those that are too low. And when you have an oil tax that has a 0% production tax or a 3% production tax on profits, I think you're at the instable kind that's too low. So the bill that we have before us says, 0% taxes, 4% taxes, 8% taxes on profits, those are low. Why don't we come up with a modest 25% tax on profits? At very high profit levels, that'll go up slightly, but at current prices, it's a 25% tax on profits. With the fiscal gap of $2.7 billion, if you actually have a capital budget, It seems like we could use the revenue, and it seems like this does it in a fair way. So this whole idea that we need a well-informed debate, I agree with. But how I'm just trying to understand why a 25% tax on profits, pretty modest, would seem so objectionable.
Commissioner Sheldon.
Thank you. Representative Guerra, I'm not prepared at this moment to respond whether or not a 25% tax on top of the other dimensions within the Alaska taxing regime is appropriate or not, and how that compares internationally. I would call it to your attention that it's almost a tripling of the tax, and I think that that has to be a substantial raise some concern about whether that's the right level. Should it be something less? Should it be something different? How should it work? And what I think we are suggesting from an administration's perspective is that the state has embarked upon a process to gather that information so that we can all make an informed decision, and we think that that would be the prudent course to take.
Through the chair.
Representative Guerra.
Representative Grant asked you about this. How substantial is the increase? And then you just talked about a tripling of the tax. So let's just, if somebody were being paid $3 an hour and we tripled their wage to the minimum wage, that would be a substantial increase in their wage, but it wouldn't really be an out-of-line wage. We have an oil tax system that charges some fields nothing in terms of production tax, some fields a minimum 4%, some fields a very low 8% tax on profits. Yeah, it's a tripling, but it's like tripling somebody's wage when they're making $3 an hour. It's not so. Yeah, it's a substantial increase because the current tax rate is so low. If that's the standard, it can't be much more than something that's way too low. Then, yeah, you'll never get anywhere, is my view.
Okay. The next question, Representative Pruitt, and then Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's been kind of fascinating. I want to make sure that this is a – would you categorize this as a substantial change to the current tax system that's in place?
I would, yes.
I think, you know, you guys just had a conversation. It is about triple what they're currently paying, which I think is pretty strong. I want to make sure that I don't – that if when I depart this room that I – I'm not speaking out of line with what I've heard. The administration does not support this bill, do they?
Commissioner.
Through the chair, the administration does not support trying to address that's true. We don't support this bill. We don't support trying to address the tax, the oil tax regime at this time in this session.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. All right, thank you. Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
You deal with oil companies that work internationally. Does it take the passing of a piece of legislation for them to feel instability from a regime from which they're working in?
I'm sorry. Could you ask that question? I'm not certain I understand.
That's okay. Do we have to pass legislation? If someone is concerned about a tax regime, is it the passage of legislation that makes them concerned, or could it be continued introduction of legislation year after year after year that might change, that makes them feel that there's an unstable regime from which they're working? You highlighted that we have had these changes back to 22. A couple of them that have they've kind of gone back and forth. But that being said, there have been more than just these particular pieces of legislation introduced during that time frame. Does it take a piece of legislation making it all the way through both bodies to create an environment or a mentality that, and I'll use Alaska, I mean, we're in Alaska, that Alaska is not a stable place from which to do business?
And if I could just very quickly, since we've got two male voices, feel free to jump in on any of the questions as you feel, but if you could just maybe identify yourself just to help with the transcription.
Ken Alpert, Director. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the Chair, Representative Parrish. So,
don't say that.
Representative Pruitt. Sorry, it's the beard. and I tremendous. I spent a lot of time in the Resources Committee the last few days. I apologize, Representative Pruitt, from the bottom of my heart. Introducing a bill is not necessarily instability. Sometimes introducing a bill indicates instability. If you go back in time before the passage of PPT, say in 2006, and I worked around this building for a period of time, and the tax rates were going down every year as the ELF was getting diluted, and the effective tax rate in Coke Park got below 1%. And there were members, and Representative Garrow was one of those voices, saying, this is unstable, this is not sustainable. But it took several years of saying that before it got through to a critical mass of individual members to agree to pass a bill that reformed that. Now, that probably triggered a process of ping-ponging back and forth in such a way that industry might have viewed as unstable, but honestly, a steady tax that gets lower and lower without any legislative changes is another form of instability. The fact that we're having this conversation isn't necessarily unstable. If we really did major dramatic changes every year, that would become unstable. I think what this conversation is doing is important because it's starting to identify and pin down where the issues might be so that when it's time to address the taxes, well, we have a fully informed body to do so. So, no, I would disagree that simply talking about taxes is a source of instability.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
So if you're one of the project that's currently in development, whether it's Liberty, which is supposed to come online in 2022, that's in permitting, GMT-2, which is in permitting 2021, and you're looking to, I mean, they have not yet put out the cash. They are in permitting. They are in the first stages. If you're looking at us potentially increasing this, and you're not certain about what the regime will remain, are you going to be cautious about putting out the capital outlay?
So this is Commissioner Fisher. Listen, through the chair, I think that when you go into a boardroom, the higher degree of uncertainty, the harder it is to make a decision. And the more certainty you can have around all of the different inputs, the better it is. And I think that we can debate whether the rationale for the uncertainty around the tax regime is because the taxes were too high and now they're too low and we're trying to kind of get to what's just right. But I do think that Alaska is a jurisdiction today that is perceived by the oil industry broadly as having risk of change in the tax regime, and that uncertainty, I do believe, will have an impact on investment decisions.
And if I may, Mr. Chairman, Ken Alper here to Representative Pruitt. Let's throw a hypothetical on these big investment decisions out there. Let's say we're looking at a very substantial tax increase, higher than this one even, bringing up to 30-something percent to start, but eliminated the minimum tax at the same time. Not suggesting it, not proposing it, but just hypothetically. From the perspective of the person investing billions of dollars and doing a cash flow analysis of an oil field for the next 30 years, that might actually be a net positive to them because in the first 5, 6, 7 years of production, they'll be able to work through all their costs and bring their taxes down to zero rather than paying at some minimum tax rate of 4% or whatever the number is at the time. And whereas all their costs get pushed years out into the future in taxes where it impacts their rates of return that much less. So these things don't happen in a vacuum. The system that we're looking at right now is, I showed in the slide at the very end of the presentation, likely to be a negative on an investment decision. But the same exact bill with a lower minimum tax might improve that same investment decision. And these are all things that's why a holistic conversation about the overall tax system with informed debate and expert analysis and global comparables and all that sort of thing is really, and all sides represented. You don't want to stack the deck with just consultants that believe in high taxes or low taxes. You want to have a conversation where people can disagree and then reach towards consensus.
And Mr. Chair, one other question.
Representative Pruitt.
So in terms of this particular bill, do you see, I guess, for the finality to figure out whether or not we should be continuing even having the discussion on this bill, do you see this bill as bringing investment to Alaska, and do you see this bill as bringing jobs or putting people to work?
So through the chair, I think that I would answer the question in a couple of respects. One is Director Alperis has highlighted their return declines modestly, and that doesn't that obviously, even though it's not an enormous change, it does make investments more difficult. But I think the bigger issue from my perspective is that if this bill were to pass, I don't think it would end the debate around oil taxes. I think we would be back in another year with some of the other issues that the director has highlighted, and we would be having this conversation would continue. And I think it's that feature that I find most troubling and most harmful, because I don't think that this is a comprehensive solution. It's a Band-Aid that will require further discussions and debates, and that I think process. When we do this, we need to do it in a way that we feel like we've got something that is a whole solution.
Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Well, this is, we're on the 85th day. We've got a working group that has only met once. They were supposed to do it. We weren't supposed to move forward. Heard the commissioner indicate that the administration doesn't support this, that this is not the right timing. I move that we table this bill.
If it is. Okay, House Finance back on record. We have a motion to table. There has been an objection. I just wanted to clarify the motion is non-debatable, and therefore, if the Secretary could please call the roll.
Representative Wilson?
Yes.
Representative Guerra?
No.
Representative Gren?
Yes.
Representative Guttenberg?
No.
Representative Kawasaki?
No.
Representative Ortiz?
No.
Yes.
Representative Tilton?
Yes.
Representative Foster?
No.
Representative Seaton?
No.
5 yay, 6 nay.
And so on a vote of 5 yay to 6 nay, the motion to table has failed. And so we will continue with debate. And so, Representative Pruitt, did you have any other comments before I go to the next?
Not right now. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I'm going to follow the list, Representative Guerra, and we'll come down to you here. I'll add you to the list. We have Representative Wilson, then Ortiz, Guttenberg, and Guerra.
So this is my 9th year here, and every year before I come, I have one prayer, and that's that we won't do oil taxes again. And just so you know, I know there's a God, but he has not answered my prayer. So we have 5 days left to get to our 90 days. And the reason I'm in favor of the tabling portion of it, do you believe, Commissioner, that if now that there's not flooding in Houston, that through the interim, the working group would be more efficient than what we have seen them thus far?
Through the chair, I believe so. I mean, I certainly hope so. Director Alper is on that committee from our department, and maybe he can talk to that more. But I think that there was a hearing earlier in this session. I think there's a recognition that this is important work.
And a little bit in follow-up, Mr.
Follow-up.
Okay, and kind of following up on Representative Pruitt. So we've had bills that have passed the House and haven't passed the Senate, but just having those discussions each and every year and having public testimony, having the companies have to come, I mean, you can't, you know, we hear that has no effect whatsoever. And so what feedback have you gotten from the companies? I mean, just even knowing every year that whether whose favorite comes into, I don't think that really matters as much as you just don't know when a bill gets dropped what will happen. I mean, have you heard, I mean, do you think investments would be different now if we could just wait at least a year before we would look at something else?
Through the chair, this is Commissioner Fisher. It's my impression, based on conversations I've had with industry, that they are seeking some sort of certainty, or at least a greater degree of certainty in terms of the tax regime. And clearly, they also want the lowest tax. I'm not going to deny that they have a self-interest associated with this. My position, I think the administration's position, is that we ought to have this conversation when we can devote enough time that we can allow all of the interested parties to feel like this issue has been settled for at least some foreseeable future, and that we aren't in a regime where we're debating this every session.
And a follow-up, Mr. Chairman?
Follow-up.
So let's say we take another industry like fishing or mining, and we just want to take a simple 25% of their profit. Do you think that would change how they do business?
Through the chair, I think that, yes, I mean, it whenever you tax more, there's a negative effect. And so that's why, that's not to say we shouldn't tax. It's to say we ought to be careful and thoughtful and make sure that the regimes that we create, we feel like are sustainable and competitive.
And Mr. Chairman, I have a question for you.
Sure, Representative Wilson.
Didn't want to leave you out. You know, I'm just a simple girl from North Pole, but, you know, I can read the writing on the wall. We've seen these presentations. I know revenue has better things to do. We're going to hear from the industry, and I'm pretty sure what we'll hear is that they will react to whatever tax or whatever bills we put out and figure out whether or not they can still stay in business or not. The public, really right now, they want their dividend, they want the budget passed, and they want us out of here, so that's pretty much it. I'm pretty sure that the vote's going to be 6 yea, 5 nays. I'm not going to count who's who as the bill moves forward. So is there really a reason we're going to do this rodeo again? And maybe instead of tabling it today, we should just make a motion. We've seen this before. I mean, everybody around the table has seen it. The public, and again, it's issues that came out of 111. But unless we want to just sit here and I'm fine doing it with Representative Guerra the whole time, and he can give his little points and I can give mine, but at the end of the day, that's just wasting time. So is it your intent to move it out on a specific date, or are people looking to amend this, or can we just let it go and see what happens? But I just don't want to be wasting industry's time, the department's time, and most of all my constituents' time, when in reality we are in the last 5 days of the session. Although I did hear we might hear bill next week. But with that aside, what is your intent?
Thank you, Representative Wilson. And I think it's up to the will of the committee. And if there are no amendments and folks would like to put it to a vote, you know, that's certainly the committee's prerogative. I would like to hear whether or not other folks are wanting to proceed, whether or not folks have amendments, whether there's a need to go forward, and if not, then we could certainly go in that direction. I guess I would first ask the sponsor of the bill, or maybe not the sponsor, but the Representative Seaton, who has been, I guess,
because we're all sponsors
on,
of the, we're all sponsors.
Well, I was going to say he's been leading on this bill, and I would like to maybe I guess get a sense of what Representative Seaton is thinking.
Sure. Thank you. Everyone should know that we will finally get the consultant, one of our consultants, before us, at least on phone, on tomorrow night. And so when people are asking, saying, what, oh, what does this mean or what does it do? And so I definitely wanted to hear from our consultants. It'll be good to hear from industry to find out if there are particular things in this bill that they like or dislike compared to what might come out in the future. I have looked at the working group as a delay group, more than a working group. I have no expectation that the working group of the legislature will work during the campaign season, where all members of the House will be running for re-election, half of the members of the Senate. So we are looking at nothing going forward, and in fact, maybe some of the people on the working group will be replaced in the next election, and therefore that working group will have to be reformatted or reformulated. So I think that we are looking at a long delay before any substantive work actually happens, and I'm really surprised that we have an idea that the working group process is going to move forward in the next year. And Mr. Fisher, maybe that's why, or Commissioner, maybe that's why you've said that you look at it sometime in the future. Sounds like distant future, which I don't think our state can afford. And so I think that the it's necessary to actually look at this issue on a broader perspective. The House Bill 111 was in the Senate for a year, and they did nothing with it. So the consultants are going to hear this bill here. They may do nothing else, but I believe that the House sent the message to the Senate that SB 26, what the commissioner has said he wants to have happen, was conditional upon looking at the oil taxes. And if they don't have those to look at, then we don't go forward probably with what the commissioner is saying he wants. So if there's nothing to compare and look at on those two fronts to actually solve some of our fiscal problem, other than just taking from a different savings account, then I don't think we make much progress. So I think that we need to look at this quite closely. And if there are amendments that come forward or suggestions from industry to how to change this model, they were very supportive of going to in 2000 and when PPT was there in 2005, I guess it was, of going to a profits-based tax because they were didn't want to go back to a gross tax only that really hits hard and at a much higher rate at low taxes, and that's what this is formulated on. Then we'll hear if they have suggestions or not. If they do have suggestions, those should be considered and make sure that we are doing what the what looks the best. But I don't think that we can sit around waiting for a small group of people to look at things and then come forward and say, hey, maybe this idea would be good when we have the bill that we passed last year that can be modified and should be able to provide stability because it's, you know, based on the model that we know of. Took care of most of the problems that were in ACEs by having bracketed progressivity instead of progressivity based on the entire tax form. So I think that we have a way of moving forward here, and so I'm supportive of this.
And Mr. Chairman, I wasn't saying to get rid of anything. I'm just saying that I think we've seen all the presentations. I don't think you're really going to change anybody's mind on here, so I'm not saying to wait for the working group. I just want to make sure that we're not wasting everyone's time just revisiting things that we already did just not too long ago.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. We do have Representatives Ortiz, Guttenberg, and Guerra in the queue, but I do would like to get more input regarding Representative Wilson's question And so I'm hearing from Representative Seaton that he would like to hear from this consultant and industry. I've got, if it's on this point, Representative Grin and then Representative Pruitt in regards to Representative Wilson's question. Representative Grin.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I agree with Representative Seaton. I'd love to have the consultant share his insights on this and hear from the public and from industry. So I have no problem coming back with continued conversations.
Thank you. Representative Pruitt?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to ask one thing. If the reason that we're doing this now is because we think the working group is a delay tactic, and I guess, you know, almost sounded like that it's not necessary. We have a member that sits on this committee that's on that. Be interested to hear if he feels that that committee is just a delay tactic and that there's no reason that we should have the committee. Maybe we should discuss getting rid of that particular committee is what it sounds like. But I think there are people that felt that it was there for a reason. I think even one of the members, the co-chairs of resources, that felt that committee was there for a reason. So if we're not going to let them do their job, why? I mean, I don't understand why we wouldn't let them do their job. But we have someone here who we could ask about that, who sits on it.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Guttenberg.
I don't want to interrupt, but I'm sorry. We have people waiting to talk. We have a bill in front of us. We've had the co-chair talk about his intent. I think we should just go about the rest of our business for today and have these discussions and continue having the hearings on the building. We already voted not to table the bill. Let's just continue on.
Thank you, Representative Guttenberg. Duly noted. I think let's at least get through tomorrow with the consultants and hearing from industry, and we can certainly discuss this, I guess, at each point along the way, and we will do what the committee would like to do. And so at this point, let's continue on. And so going back to the questions, Representative Ortiz, and then Guttenberg, and then Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Either one, I guess, I will start. Can I ask that you go to slide 4? So is it safe to say that the reason why we're having this discussion tonight, having an ongoing debate throughout the session about what we're going to do concerning our fiscal situation, it has all to do with this particular slide and particularly the 90% reduction in production taxes? Is that a fair statement to make?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, yes. I think I said something very similar when we were on slide 4. The massive reduction specifically in the production tax are the most obvious indicator as to why Alaska went from an era of structural budget surpluses to large budget deficits every year. Why are we here trying to solve all of that?
And would you also agree that in the process of us struggling with this change in this drastic change, reduction in production taxes, that the legislature, through lots of pain and struggle, has reduced UGF spending by approximately 44% since the high point of 2015. Would you agree with that?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, I would. I know it's a controversial point that people might quibble on the details, but it's true. We really have a substantial chunk of that is the capital budget. A lot of that is in things like reduction in paying for oil and gas tax credits. But a substantial percentage of that also is included within the agency budgets that have been cut dramatically top to bottom within the state over the last 4 years.
And then if you could turn to page 29, if you would. Going to the underlying statement, the most appropriate mechanism to fill this gap is via a broad-based tax tied to an overall state economy. Would you agree that the House did do that very thing?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, yes, the House passed an income tax bill in the last session that, if I remember right, had a fiscal note in the neighborhood of $700 million. It would, had it passed last year, be kicking in this coming January, and we'd be bringing in roughly that amount per year.
So my basic point is that I agree with with the sentiment expressed by a few of the people here that it seems like we're spinning our tires, maybe wasting our time. But the problem with the statement that says now is not the appropriate time to be discussing this stuff is that while theoretically that's true in a certain sense, but we don't have the luxury. And is it not fair to say that we don't have the luxury to wait to deal with our fiscal situation? During the same time that we reduced spending by 44%, we've also burned through savings of $14 billion. Is that correct?
Through the chair, plus or minus, I believe I used the number $15 billion in a presentation the other day.
And the amount of savings that we have remaining will no longer allow us to draw down on savings at the rate that we have been doing. Is that correct?
Through the chair, that's correct. The non-permanent fund savings at the end of this fiscal year is in the neighborhood of 2.5. The expectation that the legislature will in some way have to use permanent fund earnings for the FY19 budget because there simply isn't enough other money to use to fill that deficit.
So ultimately, is it fair to say that this problem is ultimately our responsibility? It's the responsibility of the legislature and the administration to address this problem. And so how can it be a dereliction of our – how can it be a waste of time? How can it be something that we shouldn't be even be talking about when ultimately if we just suspend operations and if we just say, oh, let's just go home, pass the budget, and leave it at that, how can we say that we're doing our duty in that situation?
First of all, I didn't say it was a waste of time. What I'm saying is a waste of time to try to change anybody's mind on this committee. My motion would have been to move it out of committee, move it to the floor, see what happens on the floor, and give it to the Senate. What I am saying is a waste of time is to see the same presentations we've already seen. I believe everybody, as you do and I do, already know how we would vote on this bill since we saw it last year as 111. And so what I'm saying is not to waste time, not to keep industry over here on the House side in which we've seen it, and move it along its way since we only have 5 days left. So I'm not saying not to deal with it. I'm saying very opposite of that. Since we already know what the presentations are, we've heard from industry who will then look at the bill and whatever passes will make whatever adjustments that they need to. And we will vote, and I just said that when we vote, it most likely will be 6-yea. 5-nay to move it out onto the floor, and I'm pretty sure it'll probably pass 21-19 on the floor, and I'm just saying instead of waiting 3 or 4 days to get there, why not do it today? So it was not about wasting time, except of the public and of the industry, because I think at the end of the day, everybody here knows where we're going to end up. So I'm here to stay here to midnight, and we can be back here at 7. I just want to make sure that you know, we're not wasting other people's time when we've already heard most of the things that, as Representative said, Representative Seaton told us before, these are issues that we all saw in 111. There are three ideas, and I think we pretty much have the information to know whether or not individually we want to vote on the bill. So, no, I'm on to voting on the bill.
And one last question.
I would ask if the committee could keep the temperature down. And maybe let's not make things personal. I think it's getting late. Our scheduled time was to go till 7, so I intend to take the last two folks after Representative Ortiz with their questions on the list that I currently have, and then we will adjourn out for the night. So, Representative Ortiz.
And finally, for Commissioner Fisher, I can appreciate the fact that the administration doesn't support HB 411 at this time. I can appreciate that. However, would it be the administration's position that we go to adjourn as quickly as possible and we move on for these discussions about a broad-based tax and any other potential new revenues to next legislative session? Would that be the position of the administration?
Through the chair, you know, the administration has consistently supported a full fiscal plan. The administration has supported broad-based tax, and we've supported different variations of that broad-based tax, and candidly, I think we would be open to any version of the broad-based tax that we thought would be successful through both chambers. At this point in time, however, I think we are anxious to engage in discussions that we think have a high likelihood of passing both chambers, and so we would welcome the opportunity to engage in a constructive way with both chambers on a set of solutions that we think can address what is most pressing before us today, which we think is the POMV, and then let's figure out what in addition to that and continue any open issues that may remain for future sessions.
Thank you, Representative Ortiz. And our next two questions are from Representative Guttenberg and Guerra. Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hope you're not limiting me to one question.
No. Or two. Fire away.
So, Commissioner, first I want to say I'm not here to close the fiscal gap on the backs of the oil industry. That's not why I like, I find it very appropriate to keep coming back to examining our oil tax policy. I think it's appropriate. I think the state has a huge vested interest in knowing how its resources are being developed and how the allocation of the wealth from those resources are happening, and to live up to the constitutional mandate that a fair return on our investments. We can sit in this room and watch PowerPoints all day long, and we have, and sometimes, you know, they're enjoyable and we laugh. But at the end of the day, how can we have a debate on what is the right thing for oil taxes if we don't have a bill, right? I mean, I'm looking for something that's stable for the state and the industry as well. We've had consultants here that have said over the years that it's about the rocks. People will come to find the rocks. It's what's in the rocks. Over the years, there's been dialogue comparing us on stability. I remember a presentation from one of our consultants that said, it had a PowerPoint, and it was stability around the world. Somebody hadn't changed their share in more than 30 years. Well, their take was also 97%. It was at some island state in the South Pacific. That's stability, but that doesn't work for a lot of people. But we've all come into this room over the years, and at times, at one point, somebody came in and put a more than a foot stack of documents on the table and said, these are all fiscal plans. Just cut and paste, right? We've done all this before. To not have a discussion on oil taxes in this state, and to feel that there is something that is equitable for all parties, and then to go to that line where there's a broad-based taxing Alaskans, and a lot of Alaskans don't think there's a fair and equitable relationship with the state and the industry. And my friends are very aware of the fact that there's the non-Alaskan hire in the oil industry is at all-time high. Well, not an all-time high, but for many, many years of more than 30%, 37%, that to looking at these things is an obligation that the legislature has, regardless of how good or bad it is to us. The industry is all different kind of components. You've got developers, you've got explorers, you've got just producers. Coming up with a policy that works for all of them is very difficult, and is probably, no matter what we do, there's some representative is, you know, would like some change somewhere. But at the end of the day, we can't have that discussion without a bill, right? To compare something to something else. And we have gone this far into this session without having that conversation. The industry has some angst because we're looking at it again. But I simply think that's our job. That is, even in the best of times, where are we at, what's going on. The consultants all have their opinions. But how do we address the inequities or the fairness, either side of the issue, if we don't have a bill and we're not we don't have something to discuss? So I think that is the job of the legislature and certainly the job of this committee. And I would like to wait and hear what the consultants have, because I'm not sure we've seen these before. I'm not sure who they are, but they all have different perspectives, and I'm waiting to see that. So thank you for answering my question.
That was a great, that was the best one. Would you like to respond to that question, Commissioner Fisher?
when you get thanked for answering a question, you just shut up. I think that's what you do.
Thank you. Representative Gurr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Alper, Liberty, the field that came up before, that's an offshore field, right?
Through the chair, Representative Gurr. Yes, I believe the acreage has some fractional state and fractional offshore, meaning federal land. To the extent it's federal land or federal waters, that means it would not pay the production tax.
Actually, just so I can get that clear, so I understand, through the chair, most of Liberty is offshore or all of Liberty is offshore?
Mr. Chairman, I believe I heard in the very beginning of the hearing that Jim Beckham from DNR is on the line. If he's still available, he could say that with certainty that I don't possess exactly how much of Liberty is state, federal, and so forth.
Unfortunately, I do not see a Mr. Deckerman.
Beckerman. Yes, Beckham from the Division of Oil and Gas, DNR.
Not on that. I see a T.J. Presley from Division of Oil and Gas. Is that T.J. Presley?
T.J. might know the question. Representative Garrett, suffice to say, I believe it's mostly federal. Presuming for the moment that it's entirely federal, it doesn't matter what our production tax is. It will not be taxable. However, the costs in developing that will not be lease expenditures either. They won't be carried forward to offset their taxes. The owners, and the primary owner there is Hillcorp and BP. They have other production in Alaska. Their costs from that field would not be usable to offset their taxes from their Alaska production. So Liberty is a bit of an outlier. We currently don't get even a share of the federal royalty from offshore waters. That's something our delegation's working on in D.C. It's really not an issue this committee can resolve, unfortunately. The production tax takes effect in Alaska, not just on state land, also on federal land or the near offshore that belongs to the state of Alaska.
Through the chair.
Representative Gurr.
Can you just go to page 16, please? And I know Representative Pruitt just said, for example, Liberty, but the question was, would a field like Liberty, how badly would it be affected under this law? And I think the answer should have been almost none, if at all, because none of these production taxes apply to either any of Liberty or the bulk of Liberty.
Through the chair, yes. Liberty is probably not the ideal example to use because it's federal field. But I want to make one point on this slide 16 to Representative Garrett's question, because when I've talked about this and when we've had this debate on the zero tax on GVR oil, and I've sent a memo to our office, sent a memo to Representative Garrett a couple of times in the years, it's important to distinguish when we're talking about a new producer producing a GVR field versus an incumbent producer. If Ann were to develop tomorrow, if leases were to be offered, it's my strong expectation that some of the large producers currently operating in Alaska would be bidding on those leases. And if they did develop those fields, this zero wouldn't quite work. And it's not just the blended tax thing where they'd be able to use their costs against their current production, but our law that talks about the J credits, the per barrel credits, not being able to be used below the floor, says that you can't use other credits to go below the floor either when you're using the J credit, which means for an incumbent producer in a new field, they actually get stuck at the minimum tax. It's only a new producer in a new field that's actually able to pay that zero. And it's an important distinction that we haven't really adequately expressed in testimony, and in particular the gentleman from ConocoPhillips has made issue to point that out to me in private conversation, and I wanted to take the opportunity to say that on the record that new field production from an incumbent producer generally won't be able to pay the zero. It's only a new field from a new producer.
Final, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gura.
Yeah, and Commissioner, just so you understand the perspective of some of us, and I've been, as you know, the writing's been on the wall that folks are going to have to go into the earnings reserve at some point, and even though that's the most regressive thing out there, it's something that I've recognized, as you know, and but I was also friends with Jay Hammond in his later years, and if I could magically wave a wand, I would do what Jay Hammond said was the right thing to do, which is first you get a fair share for your oil. I would go out for coffee with him, and that's what he would say. Or he'd come to my house, and that's what he would say. First, you get a fair share for your oil. Then you see if you can ask the wealthiest to chip in with some sort of income tax. And then you go to the permanent fund because that hits the poorest people the hardest. And I guess just so you understand the perspective of some of us, we feel that a fair share for your oil balances the permanent fund part. I mean, I know we've raised the dividend by $500, and that seems to have gotten consensus in the building so far by a majority of legislators. But just so you understand our perspective, it should be balanced, not just the people who have very little chip in, which is what you're proposing, but what Jay Hammond would ask me to do. And I'm sort of wondering whether he's mad at me from his grave right now, because all we have right now is a contribution from the least of thee, and I get that it's a math problem, so that has to be there, and we don't have the luxury to do oil taxes first and then later an income tax and then later the earnings reserve because we'll run out of money. But just so you understand our perspective, I'm much more of a Jay Hammond person, and right now I think he's a little bit angry at me because I'm not able to get this done, and that's the perspective of many of us.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, that $700 million is a number that's been kicked around a lot, and I think a very useful function of this bill is to be another illustration of how to get to $700 million. Last year, the House passed an income tax bill that would have raised $700 million. A tax of, you know, a medium-sized increase, call it what you will, going to the 25% rate on the oil industry would raise about $700 million at $65 oil. $1,000 from every eligible Alaskan who receives a permanent fund dividend by slashing it by that amount is $700 million. And the use of permanent fund earnings is not the same thing as cutting everyone's dividend. The use of permanent fund earnings is a structured use of our wealth. The second decision after that is how do you split that between the dividend and what's used for government, and the legislature is shifting that a little bit with the 1600 that you alluded to, but roughly speaking, we're looking at a $700 million deficit even after doing that. So I think this bill is useful for no other reason to have that conversation of what else can you do to get $700 million when you need $700 million, and here's another way to do that.
Mr. Chair. Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, and just one clarification.
Sure, Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, I did highlight Liberty earlier, and that there's minimal there that is state. But, I mean, if you really – the same point applies, though. If you want to talk about Pica with 120,000 barrel per day potential by 2021, Willow with 100,000 barrel per day, which is an appraisal, GMT-1, GMT-2, Smith Bay, 200 barrel per day. The point is still there, whether you want to focus on one that I mentioned or you want to focus on all of the things that are out there. What we do here, we're talking about a substantial amount of production that's on the line. So highlight one, or let's talk about the whole picture. I think that we need to talk about the whole picture. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Pruitt. So before we close out and before I announce what's on our docket tomorrow, Representative Seaton had introduced the bill, and so I just want to give him an opportunity to close this out. So Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the looking at the slide 16 and the questioning on the zero and since we're eliminating the per barrel credits here, I presume that that means that it would be an interesting note to see if there's anything that we need to do that hasn't been considered in when, if there's any other contingencies that rely on the per barrel credit, that if you're using those, you can't do something else. So I'd appreciate you coming back to us with any qualification on that. Also, I'd just like to say that I hope we do have a couple of technical amendments to put on the bill before we move it out, as well as there may be some amendments that come from suggestions from industry in their testimony or our consultant. Just so everyone knows, I asked the consultant not to, you know, to any warts on this or anything that he saw that were problems or improvements that could be made. I asked the consultant to, you know, fully review the program and come forward with any suggestions. So hopefully people will prepare their questions for them as well as when industry testifies, if hopefully they'll come forward with any suggestions that they think would be improvements. I would like to say that we do have legislative consultants, three sets of them. We have really not gotten their models of the Alaska tax system. And so those are legislative consultants. Those aren't consultants that are available to the administration. So I don't know if they have some other consultants that they're using, and it'd be interested to hear from their aspects on this. But I would just like to say I just cannot believe the idea that saying that if we don't need money, there would be any impetus or real impetus to go in and change the tax system on the largest taxpayer in the state. I mean, it's been a extremely difficult process to get any corrections in the oil tax system. As people will remember back in the PPT day, there were actually people went to jail in this system. And then we had ACEs in response to that. And then we've been having downgrades from that system that generated the amount that was left in the Constitutional Budget Reserve. That's what had the surpluses that we've been spending for this last several years. And now we have no system that would generate those in the future, those even at very high prices. And so we need to look at something that will get a change, both on making sure that we are not too heavy on the low end and too rich on the high end. That's a balancing act that this legislature has to do. It's not some group in the administration that will decide that. This body and the House Finance Committee, and especially, will be making that decision. So to say that we ought to just put things aside and wait for some group of administration strategists to get together and try and figure out what the legislature should do, I don't think is a path forward. And so a framework and saying, well, let's tax Alaskans, let's do all this other stuff before we ever get to the situation of considering righting the ship of oil tax and getting the maximum for the people of the state, or at least a reasonable amount for the people of the state. I think that that's what we need to consider. So I thank the committee for listening to all these presentations. I tried to keep mine short, and I hope that we look to both industry and the consultants and go forward. And thank you, Mr. Chair, for allowing me to wrap up.
Great, thank you. So with that, our next meeting is scheduled for Wednesday, April 11th at 9 a.m., and at that meeting we will hear the following bills: HB 221, Workforce and Education-Related Statistics Program, HB 304, which is the Microloan Revolving Fund and Loans, HB 384, Regulatory Commission of Alaska Broadband Internet, and HB 306, PERS CHERS Distribution. Also, tomorrow night we will be coming back to come back to HB 411 tomorrow at 5 p.m. here in the Adams Room. So with that, we will be adjourned at 7:29 p.m. Thank you.